Another year, another iPhone. But where do all the old phones go? The solid waste crisis and the history of technology and obsolescence. An interview with Giles Slade. And Bill Turkel gives us some creative ideas about what we can do with our e-waste. I'm Sean Farage, and this is Episode 7 of Nature's Past, a podcast of the Network in Canadian History and Environment. Apple recently announced the release of the third iteration of its popular mobile phone handset, the iPhone. With the introduction of yet another Apple iPhone on the market, many consumers will be upgrading and discarding their older models. In fact, according to Giles Slade, author of the award-winning book Made to Break, Technology and Obsolescence in America, by 2002, over 160 million working portable phones were retired in the United States. By 2005, more than 50,000 tons of these phones were discarded. The mobile phone now has the shortest lifespan of any consumer electronic product in the U.S. and in many other Western industrialized nations, including Canada. The problem with e-waste is made more acute by the fact that many of these products are composed of toxic substances, especially heavy metals. Slade's research historicizes the problem of e-waste by tracing its lineage to a deeper historical trend in 20th century industrial manufacturing, known as obsolescence. I spoke with Giles Slade to learn more.
Hi, this is Giles Slade, and I'm the author of Made to Break, Technology and Obsolescence in America.
Thanks for joining us this afternoon, Giles. I wanted to start off by asking you, what is the relationship between obsolescence and the environment? Why did this book win an award for environmental writing?
I don't see myself as an environmentalist, and I was surprised to win the environmental award, I think the reason that it won was because obsolescence is quite a challenge to the environment, in that it introduces waste, and a high percentage of this waste is toxic waste into the environment, so it's not able to be assimilated by our ecology. And so when I discussed electronic waste in the last chapter, this became an especially pertinent problem, and one that had not been viewed very publicly before. So I think that's why I won the award.
What brought you to the topic of obsolescence?
Well, I guess I was trying to write a book that was sort of a history of ideas, a study or approach to the idea of disposability and obsolescence. And so I just walked down this long hallway of the 20th century, opening these doors into different products and their production and marketing. And the last door I opened was electronic production, and all this bad stuff fell out on me. So until that point, I wasn't very concerned with the environment, and although my wife recycled things and often rode her bicycle and tried to conserve energy, I was openly contemptuous of these attempts. And then I realized that the problem of electronic waste was huge and invisible, and it was only one of a number of problems. And then I met David Suzuki, and I became much more interested.
So no personal experience with a cell phone cutting out on you or a computer monitor breaking?
I guess before I wrote the book, I had personal experience with a lot of things breaking when we bought a new used house, and all the appliances suddenly broke. And I began to research, when it was that durable goods, how long durable goods should last. And discover that something called a durable good is actually only lasts 3 years. That's the definition of a durable good in the United States, where much of the manufacturing either is done or originated. And I guess I was very curious to find out how this started. But my real impetus for the book was that I came back from the United Arab Emirates after 9/11, and I was walking around downtown Vancouver. impressed at how rude people are in this culture to each other, how short they are with each other, whereas in Arab culture, people spend a long time developing relationships and interacting with each other. It's part of the delight of street life. And I wondered when it was that that we had lost this quality in our lives.
So, how did the concept of obsolescence change industrial capitalism and manufacturing in the United States in the 20th century?
Obsolescence, meaning technological obsolescence, wasn't the first step. I guess the first step was to create disposable products. And that had a huge impact on industrial capitalism because it enabled corporations to create products that needed to be immediately replaced. And so if they could be branded so that their consumers remained loyal to that particular product, then they had a repetitive audience or a repetitive clientele. I call this part of the book repetitive consumption. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, if you're conditioned to use a product repetitively, you're addicted to the product, and the idea of an addictive or repetitive consumption is a central component of 20th century capitalism, and it mirrors addiction, and then a variety of products had their lives shortened deliberately in order to recreate the market for the people who manufactured them. And I guess the most notable among these was the General Motors, which began limiting the life of their cars to about 3 years. And this was all well and good. They did very well. They competed heavily against Ford. But in 1929, of course, there was a Great Depression, and the market, just as it has recently, fell out of the automobile industry. And also a variety of other industries, and just as happened recently, people were very reluctant to spend any money that they had. So you have research and development teams at firms like General Electric's experimenting with creating brighter light bulbs that lasted shorter lengths of time. So it appears that they're giving you a product benefit, but you have to buy more of them. And that's when planned obsolescence. 1932 is the date you can put it to. 1932 is really when planned obsolescence became instantiated in American capitalism, and there's been no let up since.
And you've broken down the concept of obsolescence into these three main categories: technological obsolescence, psychological obsolescence, and planned obsolescence. Can you talk a bit about psychological obsolescence?
Well, psychological obsolescence is what happened, I guess, in 1923 when Alfred Sloan, who was then the head of General Motors, just became the head of General Motors, had a very problematic car, the Chevy, that he had to market. And he'd planned to offer his customers a product benefit by radically improving the Chevy, which was not a very good car at all, with a new air-cooled system. And the air-cooled system failed at the last minute, and Sloan was stuck with an assembly line that would produce these cars, but a really rotten car that he was going to sell. So what he did was he lowered the lines of the car, redesigned the car completely, solved most of the minor problems with the car, and made it look very pretty, and undercut the price of the Ford Model T by a few hundred dollars, and basically sold this cosmetically improved car cheaper than the Ford, and really began to invade their market share. And so he learned from this, because he was a very quick learner, and he decided to do this with all General Motors products. And he cosmetically improved all General Motors products, and then began to change. He changed the overall design of each car every 3 years, and then included minor changes every year. And eventually Harley Earl, the legendary designer of General Motors products, would say something like, planned obsolescence is what drives capitalism. I'm not quoting this exactly because, it's off the top of my head. I've managed to get it down to 3 years, and when I get it down to 1 year, I'll have a perfect score.
Now, Henry Ford didn't pick up on this right away.
Henry Ford hated this. Henry Ford hated this. The idea was proposed to him by several bankers that he should shorten the lifespan of his cars. The Ford Model T lasted 7 years, which was longer than any other consumer car at the time, and Henry wanted it to last forever. He wanted one design that would last forever. He only had to buy one car for the rest of your life. He couldn't exactly do that.
Imagine that now.
Yeah. And when people encouraged him to shorten the lifespan of his car, he just treated them with utter contempt and disgust. He was a very old style. And there was a sea change in engineering that took place in the early 1900s. And Henry Ford, I guess, was the kind of farmer-friendly, durable, good value product that American engineering represented before then. There are turbines, I'm told, that were created around this time that would drive the floodwaters of New Orleans back out into the Gulf, that are still running even after Hurricane Katrina. But Alfred Sloan was a completely different thing. He was the head of the graduating class of at MIT in, I think 1872 or something like that, and his idea was very clearly to sell as much product as he could in any way that he could, and so he wanted to use technological obsolescence, which he understood very well, which was sort of each succeeding generation of product is superior to the preceding one because we know more. He tripped over psychological obsolescence, which is cosmetically improving the product and changing it according to seasons of fashion, and then very soon they moved into planned obsolescence, which was deliberately limiting the lifespan of their products in order to sell more product.
Just to continue then on this point, Ford eventually gives in to this idea of psychological obsolescence with the Model A. So does Sloan's idea and his concept of manufacturing in the automobile industry with an annual model change, does this win out?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I guess Sloan's, I guess in 1927 when Henry Ford stopped production of the Model T, he stopped production of the Model T because nobody was buying it anymore. They'd lost too much market share, and in order to remain in the field, he had to redesign it. It was an archaic piece of ugly farm machinery that came in one color, and General Motors was producing beautiful-looking things that came in any color you wanted. And women, by this point, had 80% or 90% say in the purchase of every automobile. So you couldn't design a thing that looked like a Massey Ferguson tractor. No offense to Massey Ferguson. So he was forced to, if he wanted to compete, to redesign it. He redesigned it. It cost him at least $100 million. $100 million we know of, I think, much more. The secret went to his grave with him. They had to cease production for 9 months of the year, and they produced the Model A, which immediately picked up a huge market share. But Henry didn't quite get it, and said that this was the last time Ford would do this, and he never wanted to redesign the product again. And of course, by the 30s, when the bottom had fallen out of the market, they had to switch over to the annual model change in order to compete with General Motors, who was selling more cars in America than Ford was. And the same thing happened to their tractors, the Fordston tractors.
And there are remarkable parallels now that you can see today with the annual model change by the end of the 1920s with the annual model change on digital music players with iPods.
Oh, yeah. Well, isn't only annual now. I think there's an annual Apple show that brings out the new models for each year. But these new models sort of have subdivisions and new colors and whatever. Consumer electronics, I guess, is really the cutting edge of planned obsolescence these days. In Japan, I think things are now replaced at 6 to 8 months. So mm-hmm. people generally get a new phone 6 to 8 months of the year. It's less than a year. Excuse me. In North America, especially during these times of recession, perhaps it's a year or a year and a half now.
Wow. But before computers and digital music players and mobile phones became these nearly disposable consumer electronics, there was the radio. Could you talk a little bit about how obsolescence or strategies of obsolescence were applied to early radio production?
Early radio production, the 30s.
Oh, and maybe right up into the 1950s.
Yeah, okay. Well, I guess there's two steps to this. Early radios were huge things. They were cabinet components. That were quite expensive, and no one could afford them during the Depression. So during the Depression, they began to make smaller tabletop radios. There's a model called the Tombstone that looks like a tombstone that's on top of your desk. That's was considerably cheaper. I think it would now. I don't want to say this authoritatively, but I think. I remember seeing, you know, a cabinet radio for $269, whereas a tabletop radio itself would cost about $69. Mm-hmm. The quality of sound in the tabletop radio wasn't nearly as good because the speakers couldn't be as large, and quality of sound depended on large speakers in those days. So the very tinny kind of songs that we think of characteristic as of this period are really a function of how radio has shrunk in size. And this began to, I guess, valorize, I think, miniaturization. I think this is where miniaturization came from. Mm. The fact that that it was smaller meant that it was much more affordable and therefore much more desirable. And so manufacturers and also radio dealerships couldn't unload the big ones anymore. And in order to be modern, you had to have a tabletop model, which was very difficult to do when nobody was making any money. And into the 50s, what happened was earlier in the 1940s, during the war, electronic components had shrunk considerably because they had to be fit into aircraft, and the payload of aircraft was a vital consideration. If they're flying across oceans, how much weight they're carrying is really an essential consideration. And so at first tubes were miniaturized, and at the end of the war, with these miniaturized tubes that have been used in, I guess, aircraft circuitry and also in bomb circuitry mm-hmm. during the war, a manufacturer designed the first pocket radio, which didn't sell very well, unfortunately, called the Boulevard, and they're collector's items these days. But that proved that there was it proved the idea of a pocket radio was possible. And this is something that had been dreamed about in sort of science fiction and popular novels and even comic books since the 20s. Dick Tracy had a wrist communicator since,
right.
I don't know what the date was, but very early on. And so a variety of manufacturers started flooding into this, including Zenith. And the transistor was invented very soon. And some people in Japan who became Sony got a license to produce these transistors. And the first American radios produced with transistors weren't very good. They were all hand-wired, which meant that they were enormously expensive. But Sony created a variety of new radios that had innovative circuit boards that would handle the transistors. And they shipped them off to America in the 50s, I think. I don't remember the exact year, 55, 56, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Right around the time when rock and roll was first breaking. And so the transistor radio, the Japanese transistor radio, became a consumer item for young people who were listening to this new music. And of course the speakers were very small, but rock and roll, there's that expression, close enough for rock and roll. When you're tuning a guitar, rock and roll didn't require large speakers. And
this confluence of technology and culture.
That's right. And also, Japanese discovered that it was far cheaper and much more amenable to psychological obsolescence to package these things in lightweight plastic containers that could be colored, resin containers that could be colored very easily. And so they bring out a variety of flashy new colors and made them look as flashy as possible. And the most wonderful thing about this was, of course, when you drop them, they broke. And I don't know if you noticed this with cell phones, but the first generation cell phone, you know, you could throw it on the floor and jump on it, and it wouldn't break. But now, you know, if you have a flip phone, God help you if you take it out of your pocket too quickly. And so they made them very cheaply, and very amenable to destruction. And sold a lot of them because of this. And I think this reinforced our aesthetic of miniaturization, which has come to, you know, the Air and the iPod Nano that, you know, is as thick as a pen, and, you know, all these wonderful things that we have nowadays. I notice you have an Acer netbook.
Yes.
Much smaller than my wife's Dell laptop. It shrunk in the space of about 5 years. It shrunk about half size.
Well, maybe we can talk about computers then. All of our listeners will have downloaded this podcast on a computer. Could you explain what Moore's Law is and whether or not computer technology represents something entirely different in terms of the relationship between obsolescence and manufacturing?
It represents a really predictable curve. I guess what Moore did was he just noticed the curve. He charted the growth of power and an ability to miniaturize electronic circuitry, and noticed that every 18 months it doubled, and this. This was an enormously powerful way to predict the future of the electronics industry. It enabled them to do very accurate budgets, and also to discount their products and price their products plan their marketing strategies. So Moore's Law says that every 18 months the power of the an electronic component will double in size while it shrinks. And so far it's been completely true.
And has this had any effect on consumer behavior, if it's so predictable that it'll change over a certain period of time?
Well, it once again, it reinforces miniaturization in you know, makes us believe that you know, the smallest component is the most recent and therefore the most powerful and most modern, and we're willing to pay a premium to get it. And for people who lead the field, I guess for consumers who are regarded as leading tech consumers that other people follow and imitate and watch.
The so-called early adopters.
Yeah, the early adopters. You know, they create, a sort of must-have kind of sense for the rest of us. And so, it has a huge influence. But I don't know what's happening to it in this current recession. I know that Apple, it really surprises me, Apple is still making money, really good money, hand over fist. I think because Steve Jobs has short-circuited the market and not made it a chase for the lowest common denominator, but rather has placed Apple into a position where that Sony once was, it no longer is, where Apple is the luxury product, the classiest, best-designed product with the best performance. And so people, it's like 2 cents more to smoke a Lucky or something like that. You know, people want that product more than they want anything else. And I mean, even this thing, I don't know what we're recording, and we're recording in MP3 or
Yeah.
We're recording an MP3, but you're calling it a podcast. I mean, you know, he's so completely taken over the market that the nomenclature is proprietary.
Maybe we should be calling this a netcast or digital audio recording, internet-distributed digital audio recording.
I think, you know, the true genius of Steve Jobs has not been measured and will not be measured yet. I think he's just astounding. He's a figure like Edison or Henry Ford.
You've spoken a little bit already about planned obsolescence, but I wonder if you can elaborate a little bit more on this idea and how it changed in the 20th century and where it is today.
It's under fire, and I'm glad that it's under fire. It was a way to... it acted like steroids on capitalism. It created our consumer culture. Unfortunately, it produced enormous amounts of waste. And when you have global proportions of waste, you have global proportions of toxins, and also you draw down, I guess, on the natural resources that are making these components to such an extent that now 70% of our steel is recycled steel. We don't have enough steel to last us in the next 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Aluminum, bauxite, copper, we're running out of all these things, and we'll have to mine our landfills in order to get a hold of it. So it has a kind of negative planned obsolescence, because it produces so much waste, has a negative effect both upstream and downstream. And it's really a careless, insouciant kind of way of looking at engineering and manufacturing and design, and we passed that point. So now designers have moved into what they call cradle-to-cradle design, green design, cradle-to-grave design, where they begin to think of not the product lifespan, but the lifespan of the components and the materials that go into it, how those can be recycled and reused. And that changes things radically.
So, the big question then. In your last chapter, you write, "During the next few years, the overwhelming problem of waste of all kinds will, I believe, compel American manufacturers to modify industrial practices that feed upon a throwaway ethic. If, as you argue in the book, industrial manufacturing developed in the 20th century in the United States based on a variety of different strategies of obsolescence, is there an alternative model that avoids or mitigates the problem of waste management and the current solid waste crisis?"
There's an emerging model. I don't think there's a model in place yet, but people are experimenting with new things. Caterpillar, which recently had, disastrous financial consequences due to the recession, saves up to 70% of its cost by taking back its old products and just disassembling them, saving everything, including the bolts, and reusing the bolts. I mean, so 70% of the manufacturing cost of a product can be saved in this way. BMW does the same thing. And there are a variety of European companies that do the same thing. It depends on showing corporations, which aren't necessarily the most sensitive organizations, that it's in their best interest to that they can save money or that they can earn money by behaving in a way that's completely unfamiliar to them and perhaps at first seems kind of hostile to them. And I think the European Union began this when they passed legislation that banned the use of toxic components in electronic products and compelled manufacturers to come up with alternatives to solder and cadmium and brominated flame retardants and things like that just poison the environment. So really, unless industry is compelled to do this, no new model will emerge, but industry is being compelled to do this by different things, legislative and also cost saving.
And possibly environmental limits that may ultimately compel them toward these new models.
Yeah, well, environmentally motivated laws that have teeth in them. Mm-hmm. There's a list of, you know, ethical companies out there. I can't think of a manufacturer who would do this out of the kindness of his heart. You know.
The book is Made to Break: Technology and Obsolescence in America. I want to thank you for coming in and talking to us about it.
Thanks very much. It was fun.
E-waste is obviously a serious 21st century environmental challenge. While Slade's book helps us to understand the historical roots of the problem, other historians have been busy working out in the field thinking about ways to raise awareness and find present-day solutions. Professor William Turkell from the Department of History at the University of Western Ontario, along with a group of environmental historians, digital humanists, historians of science and technology, artists, designers, and hackers, got together to address the e-waste crisis through a three-day hacking workshop called Hacking as a Way of Knowing. Bill took some time to tell us a little bit more about the workshop.
Okay, my name is Bill Turkell, and I'm an assistant, soon to be associate professor of history at the University of Western Ontario.
Well, thanks for joining us. We're glad to have you on the podcast, Bill. What I wanted to ask you was, what is a hacking workshop, and why did Niche Digital Infrastructure co-sponsor this workshop?
Okay, well, let me just tell you a little bit about it. We invited about 20 people, a mix of academics, mostly science studies people, some designers from the community, some students, and then other just sort of interested individuals. We invited these people to a three-day workshop at a place called InterAccess, which is a media arts center in Toronto. And we gave the participants a stack of kind of discarded consumer electronic devices, and we asked them to work in teams to take apart those products and to reuse the components. And what we wanted them to do was to try to create new devices or gizmos or works of art or what have you that reflected on our kind of society's relationship with the environment in some way, or that reflected on the problem of environmental waste.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of more generally... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, and what sort of things did people make?
Oh, they made all kinds of fun stuff. So, for example, one of the teams decided to create a mechanical flower that only blooms under artificial light. So they had to design a circuit that could tell natural light from artificial light. And when the conditions were right, this would power a motor, and the idea was this little sort of Frankenstein flower would bloom under the artificial light. Another group took a record player and some printer mechanisms, and they made this plotter that responds to keywords and news feeds. And so, for example, they could plot mentions of containment against mentions of swine flu or something like that. And then a fellow at the University of Western Ontario, a PhD student named Devin Elliott, decided to take a desktop scanner that someone had thrown away and turn it into a kind of pinhole camera. So he was able to take these distorted portraits of participants and their projects on the last day of the workshop, and that was a big hit.
So what were some of the origins of this event? Where did this emerge?
Well, the idea of a hacking workshop is that although we're not very familiar in the social sciences and humanities, most of us aren't very familiar with either making things or working with our hands on a kind of a day-to-day basis, there is a lot of knowledge that gets encoded in physical things or in processes of fabrication or manufacture. And the idea was to expose people to this way of knowing, that making things is a way of knowing about them, and repurposing them or modifying them is also a way of knowing about the world that we don't often engage in, but that we can learn a lot from when we do.
And this had some sort of linkage to the problem of e-waste. Could you explain what e-waste is and the scope of the e-waste problem?
Sure, of course. Yeah, basically, there's really two facets to the problem of e-waste. The first is that we've seen a really rapid expansion of the digital world and to a significant extent to the global economy, too. And that's been largely driven by the fact that electronic hardware has been improving at exponential rates for decades. So every year or two, the power of electronic devices doubles, and the size usually is cut in half and so forth. the fellow who first noticed this, an engineer named Gordon Moore, said that if the same thing had happened in the automotive industry, we'd now have a Rolls-Royce that could get 1,000,000 miles per gallon, and it would be cheaper to throw it away than to park it. And that's not far wrong. In the Western world, a lot of us use these wonderful little devices, and we kind of throw them away long before their lifespan is over so that we can buy the next new thing. That's kind of one half of the equation. The other half of the equation is that a lot of manufacturing, not all manufacturing, but a lot of electronics manufacturing is a relatively toxic process, and it's often done for economic reasons in poor countries. And so the conditions that these devices are manufactured in are occasionally or often environmentally and socially unjust. So we've been kind of consuming and throwing these things away rapidly. And elsewhere, poor people are kind of being exploited and exposed to quite toxic conditions to keep the whole system growing as fast as possible.
So this is just one project that the Niche Digital Infrastructure team has sponsored recently. What other projects are you guys working on?
Okay, well, a lot of our work at the moment and often is focused on the website and on stuff that you don't see behind the scenes, like system administration to make sure that the website is running properly and that we have room to develop new projects and that kind of thing. We've recently been wrapping up a Shirk-funded project that developed prototypes of different kinds of devices to help us communicate within the knowledge cluster to take advantage of kind of more ambient ways of understanding things or more tangible ways of understanding. We're starting a new collaboration this summer with the New York Public Library to focus on open source geospatial software. And we're going to work to co-host an online demonstration exhibit on the Klondike Gold Rush. And then this coming fall, we're hosting another Shirk-funded conference on what are called application programming interfaces, or APIs. And, you know, without getting into too much technical detail, the idea behind an API is that it makes it easy for programmers to take data from one site, like, say, Early Canadiana Online, and to mash it up with information from another site, like Google Maps or Google Earth. And so we have all these kind of projects on the go, and we'll be putting up information on them on the Niche website as we go throughout the year.
Great, and that's at niche.uwo.ca. And I saw as well that you guys will be putting up photos from the hacking workshop.
Yeah, if by the time this podcast comes out, the website for that project should be up. I'm just putting the final touches on it with Adam Krimble right now.
Great. So listeners can go check that out. Bill, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure.
For more information, pictures, and videos from the workshop, visit the Digital Infrastructure page on the Niche website at niche.uwo.ca/digital-infrastructure. Nature's Past is produced with support from the Network in Canadian History and Environment. This episode was made by Giles Slade, Bill Turkell, and me, Sean Karash. Music for Nature's Past was licensed by Creative Commons. For details on the artists, please take a look at our show notes at niche.uwo.ca/naturespast, where you can also download new episodes, subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, and leave comments. Please let us know what you think about the podcast, and don't forget to rate this podcast and write a short review on our iTunes page. If you have any ideas for new episodes or you want to send me some feedback, you can contact me through my website, seankaraj.wordpress.com. That's seankaraj.wordpress.com. You can always get the latest information on events in the environmental history community from the Niche website at niche.uwo.ca, and you can follow Niche on Twitter at twitter.com/niche_Canada. Thanks for listening, and be sure to download our next episode.